Pretty good. So the subject, of course, of our class is the Heart Sutra. What is the meaning of the Heart Sutra? And what is it expressing? And how do we understand it? So I do this periodically, maybe once every 10 years or so, to catch everybody up and remind those who have some understanding. We chant the Heart Sutra every day, twice a day, and we may understand it, or we may not. When I was at Sokoji, our original temple in San Francisco on Bush Street, we used to chant the Heart Sutra in Japanese only three times. That was our service. And the chanting card had the characters, and then had a translation of the characters. So we could follow the meaning of the Chinese characters and the Japanese transliteration. And 1970, when Tatsugami Roshi came to Tassajara, we made a translation which was kind of culled from various translations, and that's pretty much what we have today with some minor changes. So this translation is sufficient. There are a number of translations, and there are a number of commentaries. Edward Kanze, who was a German scholar, I remember he got his PhD in 1929, my birthday. really made the Prajnaparamita texts available in English. A great translator, really good translator. I can't believe what a good translator he is, because he didn't have anybody else around him who was doing this. And his translations still hold up today. And I studied his translation of the Heart Sutra many times, and usually taught from that. And he breaks it down into its various components. Because the Heart Sutra is a very short version of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Prajnaparamita Sutras were introduced into the world somewhere between the first and the third centuries. The Prajnaparamita Sutras, and especially the Heart Sutra, which is kind of a condensation of the 600 so-called volumes of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, contains everything we need to know about it in a little bundle. So that's why it's so difficult to understand, because it's talking about all of the practices of the complete understanding of Mahayana Buddhism. So when we read it, like, what's it talking about? It's not explaining anything, it's simply presenting. So in order to understand, you have to study what it's talking about. So Kanze does that very well. The Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra are these two sutras which talk about emptiness and wisdom, and what compassion really is. But they're very short, and they're even shorter ones. When you get down to looking at all the short versions of the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the last one is the letter A. The Sanskrit letter A is the shortest version of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and the longest version is the one in 100,000 lines. And we have a copy of Khonsa's translation of the one in 18,000 lines. I would kind of bring it, but it's too heavy. We have a copy in the library. And when you open it up, you cannot believe who wrote this. It always boggles my mind. Nobody knows who wrote all this. But who wrote this? Who wrote the sutras? It's unbelievable. When you start reading them, they're so detailed and so systematically put together. It just boggles the mind how anybody in those days, in the maybe the second century, wrote all this stuff down. But the understanding is, the understanding used to be there was this, the long sutra, like in 100,000 lines. And then it was divided into smaller pieces, so, you know, it would be less cumbersome. But actually, it seems to work the other way. There's the small sutra, and then it keeps being expanded. That's the way sutras come to be, actually. There's a treatise, or somebody writes something down, and then people add to that. The Lotus Sutra is like that. People add to it, and it keeps getting more and more chapters up to a point. So it's not like one person may have written it, but the Prajnaparamita Sutras is so consistent in what it's talking about that it was supposed to have been discovered by Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is the great patriarch of the Mahayana. All the schools of the Mahayana consider Nagarjuna the 14th ancestor as the patriarch of Mahayana, of the middle way, Majjhimika. Majjhimika means middle way. Basically, the understanding of the non-duality of form and emptiness. So when we look at the Heart Sutra, the heart of the Heart Sutra is form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That which is form is emptiness, that which is emptiness form. The same is true of feelings. The same is true of perceptions. The same is true of mental thought conceptions. And the same is true of consciousness. They're all empty in their own being. So that's the center of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. And it's expressed in the Heart Sutra in a very condensed way. And of course, the larger sutras are much more expanded and incredible, actually. Just like the Avatamsaka Sutra, who could have written such a thing, you know? Nobody knows. So there are unnamed authors. But how they could have had such conceptions is pretty incredible. So there must have been some, you know, momentum from Buddha's time, tremendous momentum from Buddha's time and from Shakyamuni to have inspired all of this. So we say that, so the commentary that I have chosen is the commentary which you have by Abbot Obora, who is around the first part of the 20th century. I don't know when he died. I can't remember when he died. But probably in the 50s or 40s, 50s. And he was interviewed by Trevor Leggett, who was a kind of scholar, and also lived in Japan a long time. And I think he was a black belt in karate and had and various other accomplishments. And he very sensitively translated put this book together as interviews from Abbot Obora. And Abbot Obora's attitude, or what his presentation is based on, realizing the emptiness of our daily life activities without getting rid of anything. Seeing how all of our mistakes, all of our striving, all of whatever we have that we call ourselves and our ambitions and daily life without eliminating anything can be the vehicle for our salvation. In light of emptiness, the world of emptiness. And so this is a commentary on the Heart Sutra, and it's just all about daily life. Our feelings, emotions, our ambitions, our mistakes, our whatever it is. How to find ourselves, our freedom moment after moment, within the difficulties of our life. That's the message of the Heart Sutra, according to him. And this is basically Soto Zen teaching, Soto Zen attitude. So I've been reading this book since 1964, when it came out. And it's my favorite commentary on the Heart Sutra. There are many commentaries, really good commentaries. Thich Nhat Hanh has a very nice commentary. It's short. And there's a lot of Tibetan commentaries, but they're very intellectual. Pretty intellectual. They're good, though. I mean, if you like, Kanze says, the Heart Sutra understanding, you have to have an intellect in order to approach it. You have to have some intellect. It's not for the person who doesn't want to use his intellect. But it carries you beyond your intellect. Your intellect takes you so far, but you should use it and then jump off. So I'm assuming that you all have your translation. I mean your copy of Abbot Obora. And I also gave you a copy of Kanze's translation and commentary. So I hope you brought them with you. You should always bring them with you. Not only that, but you should read them. It always helps to read them. So, I'm going to jump in. If you have a question, it's okay to bring up a question. But if we get into too many questions, we never get past the first or second lines. So I don't want to get hung up on questions. But there will be an opportunity if I'm reminded, because I tend to kind of go off, to stop and have questions. So you may have a burning question, but just hold it. That's good practice. That's practice of Prajnaparamita. Is to, you have a burning question, just hold it until an appropriate moment. Ross?
We'll have a break for maybe a minute or two to stretch at a particular time.
Yes, so halfway.
The timekeeper will know what time.
Yeah, 40 minutes we have a break. Yeah.
So it's like 8 o'clock maybe, 7:15 to 8 o'clock.
I can't remember the time exactly, but we used to have it.
That's what Kali knows. When the race is right.
Remember?
Yeah, that's in only 20 minutes, though.
Huh?
8 o'clock is in only 20 minutes, though.
Yeah, so at some point, when it feels right. So I'm going to just, I want to, well, there, you know, there are many things that I want to say, but this is the study of form and emptiness. So we think we know what form is, but we're not sure that we know what emptiness is. You know, we have the glass that's full of water, and we say, the glass is full of water. Right? So it's a glass full of water. I drink a little bit, there's still water, but the glass is actually empty as well as full. Even though the glass is full, it's always empty. It's always empty because everything is empty of its own nature. Emptiness is the nature of everything. So this is the message of the Heart Sutra. So I'm going to talk about emptiness and give you, there are as a list of 18 emptinesses. 18 meanings of the word emptiness in the Dharma. So these are the 18 names of emptinesses. Inside is empty. You don't have to write this down. I can Xerox it for you. You can write it down if you want.
Did you say inside?
Inside.
Inside.
As opposed to outside. Inside is empty, but outside is also empty. Inside and outside are empty. Emptiness is empty. The great elements are empty. Reality is empty. Creative purpose is empty. Purposelessness is empty. The conclusion is empty. The beginningless is empty. Undoing phenomena is empty. Your own nature is empty. All existence is empty. One's own appearance is empty. The ungraspable is empty. Non-existence is empty. Existence is empty. And non-existing existence is empty. That sounds like a Dogen. So this is a great book, Zen Pivots by Sokeon Sasaki. Sokeon Sasaki was back in the 30s, was the teacher at the First Zen Institute in New York. And his talks, in the 30s, he was like all over this country. He was the only Zen priest. He was a Rinzai Zen priest in this country. And he had a remarkable life. And he gave a lot of talks and so forth. And his lectures were printed in this book and another book. I don't want to say insightful, but more than insightful, they're profound. But he has an explanation of what each of these emptinesses mean, which I'm not going to go into. I just want to give you a sense of the various meanings, or non-meanings, the meaningless meanings and meaningless meanings of emptiness. And if you like, we can make some Xerox copy for you with the explanations. whether it's meaningful or not to you. So, I'm just kind of, this is like an overview of basic look at what we're talking about. So, Kanzen divides the Heart Sutra into 8 sections. The first section is the invocation. Somebody say something. First is the invocation before the title. But we don't have the invocation. So this is called the Heart Sutra with the invocation is called the longer version. So I will read you the longer version. Introduction. For chanting purposes, they took this part out. So, in this introductory part, it gives the setting for the sutra, for the Heart Sutra. Thus have I heard. The Lord dwelled at Rajagriha on the Vulture Peak, together with a large gathering of both monks and bodhisattvas. At that time, the Lord, after he had taught the discourse on Dharma called Deep Splendor, had entered into concentration. At that time, also, the Holy Lord Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the Great Being, coursed in the course of the deep perfection of wisdom. He looked down from on high, and he saw the 5 skandhas, and he surveyed them as empty in their own being. Thereupon, the Venerable Shariputra, through the Buddha's might, said to the Lord, Holy Lord Avalokita, the Bodhisattva, the Great Being, how should a son or daughter of good family train themselves if they want to course in the course of this deep perfection of wisdom? So that's the setting. Buddha sitting there with the arhats and bodhisattvas and so forth, and Avalokiteshvara is there. Avalokiteshvara, of course, is the personification of compassion. Right, Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom, but he's not talking to Manjushri. He's talking to Avalokiteshvara. So this is kind of interesting because it's talking about wisdom. The sutra is about wisdom, but it's also about compassion. here is the Lord. Buddha, in his samadhi called Deep Splendor. Suzuki Roshi used to say, talk about nothing special, because he didn't want to get people to get excited about enlightenment and stuff like that. So he said, it's nothing special. And this was in the 60s. There was a matchbook cover that came out that said, Deep Splendor is nothing special. Nobody knew where that matchbook cover came from. So this is the setting for the sutra. It says, thus have I heard at one time, the Lord dwelled at Rajagriha on the Vulture Peak, together with a large gathering of both monks and bodhisattvas, At that time, the Lord, after he had taught his discourse in Dharma called Deep Splendor, had entered into concentration. At that time, also, the holy Lord Avalokita, the Bodhisattva, the great being, coursed in the course of the deep perfection of wisdom. It doesn't, it says coursing, meaning practice. Sometimes it's translated as practice, sometimes it's translated as coursing. Kanze translates it as coursing, but others translate it as practicing. It is practice. It's not just an idea. He was practicing. So that's very important. He looked down from on high, and he saw the five skandhas, and he surveyed them as empty in their own being. Thereupon, the Venerable Shariputra, through the Buddha's might, said to the Lord, Holy Lord Avalokita, the Bodhisattva, the great being, how should a son or daughter of good family train themselves if they want to course in the course of this deep perfection of wisdom? Now, good family is always a... What do you mean, good family? You mean just the elite or what? No. Don't ask me. I don't know what it means. I think it means Buddha family. How should a person who is part of the Buddha family, someone who follows the Dharma, of course, in Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. The other thing is that it's important here that Shariputra is the one who asks, or the one who wants to know. So Shariputra, you know, Shakyamuni had 16 major followers, monks who were his followers, and each one had a, he also had 500, but there's 16 where they're like the core of his Sangha. And these were the closest to him, and each one had a certain power, certain ability. And Shariputra is the one who had the, who was proficient in wisdom. Characteristic, his main characteristic was that he was really very wise. But he's asking Avalokiteshvara, how do you course in Prajnaparamita? He didn't know anything about Prajnaparamita. So this Heart Sutra, or the Prajnaparamita Sutras, but it's characterized in the Heart Sutra, is a kind of criticism, I don't like to say criticism, but correction, a departure from the Hinayana, so to speak, way of understanding. It's a criticism of the Hinayana means small vehicle, as you know. Mahayana means great vehicle. Hinayana is not any special school. Sometimes people say Theravada is Hinayana, but it's not necessary to assign Hinayana or small vehicle to any specific school. It's merely those practitioners, those philosophers, and who are stuck in the duality of the Dharma. Basically, for example, the arhat as a the arhats were the followers of Buddha, so were the bodhisattvas, but the 16 arhats, his followers, are considered arhats who attained enlightenment and nirvana. Nirvana is very important part of this sutra, part of this understanding. So, to make a long story short, the arhat tried to separate nirvana from samsara. Samsara means the illusory world of form. To to separate the illusory world of form from the pure world of emptiness. And so their whole practice, their whole understanding as monks mostly, was to find nirvana by totally rejecting samsara, our life of form. But the Mahayana, and of course the Prajnaparamita, is the expression of the Mahayana, which says you can't separate them. You can't separate nirvana from samsara. You can't separate nirvana from your daily life or the way we exist in this world. So instead of separating to find nirvana within the dust of the world. That's Mahayana stance. So that's what the Heart Sutra is expressing. How to realize the purity within the impure instead of separating the impure from the pure. You can't, like a fish can't live in pure water. The lotus only grows in the mud. In the muck. It has a nice mucky field in order to grow. So that's kind of like the difference. So we find our, and this Avalokiteshvara is expressing that throughout his commentary. That's his major expression throughout the commentary, and he gives many, many examples of daily life. He's Japanese, and he has a Japanese view of life, cultural view, which you may or may not agree with or align yourself with. But I think everything he's saying is quite illustrative of our life. You don't have to be Japanese. Well, I'm sure some of you have read this, some of it.
I hope.
So I'm not springing something on you. So Kanze, you know, was here for a long time, and he was taught at Cal, and Suzuki Roshi sent us up there to listen to him, and he was quite a character. He wrote his own biography, which has never been printed, but it's very interesting. He talks about everybody he knew, and he said, anyway, so that's the invocation that I've just read to you. And then the prologue is Avalokitesh Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceive that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. If you look, I didn't give you this translation, but nevertheless, if you look, the translation is there in your, it's right there. Does everybody see that? Some of you are looking at me when you should be looking at your book. The first page is the translation, I think. Or the second page or something. Avalokiteshvara? What page is it on?
The translations are, you know, the beginning of each.
And you're looking at the Kanze.
Kanze, yeah.
No, I'm looking at, I'm talking about the other one.
Okay.
Because Kanze's is spread out.
Yeah. It's the beginning. So.
The beginning of the Tiger's Cave.
It's a different council.
translation.
Yes, but it's not that different.
Right.
It's okay that it's a different translation. You can follow it. So the prologue is Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. And then, the dialectics of emptiness is what he calls this kanze. But I'm used to these three different, but you can follow this. O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions. Impulses are mental formations and consciousness. That's the dialectics of emptiness in the first stage. The dialectics of emptiness in the second stage, in the fourth stage, is O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear, nor disappear, are not tainted, nor pure, do not increase, nor decrease. This is an overview. Dialectics of emptiness, third stage. Therefore, in emptiness, or given emptiness, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no impulses, no consciousness, no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no touch. No object of mind, no realm of eyes, until no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance, and also no extinction of it, until no old age and death. This is the dialectics of emptiness of no. No, 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 no. Moo, 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 moo. And then there's the concrete embodiment of full emptiness in its practical basis. No suffering, no origination, no cognition, also no attainment. With nothing to attain, this is the concrete embodiment of full emptiness. With nothing to attain, the bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, and his mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view or upside-down view, he dwells in nirvana. And then the next section is the full emptiness is the basis of Buddhahood. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. And then the teaching brought within the reach of the comparatively unenlightened. Therefore know the Prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, the great bright mantra, the utmost mantra, the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, proclaim the mantra that says gapte, gapte, pada, gapte, pada, sam, gapte, bodhisattva. So this is line by line, and the sections, as outlined by Kanze. So this is the overview, and we will try to illuminate everything as we go along, and go slow, for the benefit of the comparatively unenlightened. Yes.
It's 5 after 8. Can we just take a
while? You feeling uncomfortable? Maybe.
Yes, I heard a yes. Maybe 1 minute, 2 minutes.
Yeah, stand up for 1 minute. Don't go to the bathroom unless you have to. Okay. The title, you know, is Maha Pragna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. So Maha means great, and Pragna is wisdom. Paramita means beyond, and Hridaya is the heart, and Sutra means the etymology of sutra is something beads like strung on a string. So like words that are strung together. So pragya, a great is great, and pragya is the wisdom of, it's intuitive wisdom. It's not exactly knowledge in the usual sense, because intuition is our direct knowing without having to go through the the process of analysis, of mental analysis. And paramita means beyond or gone. The we say wisdom gone beyond wisdom. And Hridaya is heart, meaning like the center or the living center. So great wisdom beyond heart sutra. But paramita has several meanings. It's like sometimes in that mantra at the end means the other shore. Going beyond. Like there's this shore, this is samsara, and this is nirvana, and there's this something in between. But the wisdom of pragya takes out the thing that's in between, while leaving the thing that's in between there. This non-duality is very difficult to grasp intellectually. It's like, even though the cup is full, it's empty. So we have to go beyond our ordinary logic of duality. We don't have that logic of duality. It's learned. When you're a baby, babies don't have it. They just pick up everything. And, you know, I got a wonderful picture in my office of this baby looking at a hose and the water's coming out of his face. But we learn how to operate in the world of duality. So duality is where we live. We live in the world of comparative values. The world of comparative values is called samsara. And the world without comparative values, or beyond comparative values, is called nirvana. But nirvana includes the world of samsara. And that samsara includes the world of nirvana. So to cross over is gives the impression that you're going from one place to another. But as my old teacher used to say, when you understand how to live on this side, you're already on the other side. So there really is no other side. It's just the figure of speech. So, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a junior Buddha. When practicing deeply, coursing deeply, the Prajnaparamita, perceive that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. So the purpose of Buddhism, according to Shakyamuni, is to save us from suffering. That's the plan. All the rest is commentary on that. So what are the five skandhas? Skandha of form, which is the body. When we're talking about the skandhas, we're talking about the person, which of course accords with phenomena around us, but strictly speaking, this form body is the body, the skandha of form. And then there's the skandha of feelings, bodily feelings or emotional feelings or mental feelings. So we say, I have a feeling about da, 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 that's a feeling, or oh, my body hurts, that's a feeling. So any kind of feeling is a feeling. These are called five streams. They're five streams that come together, but they're separate, but they form one body. So, form, feelings, perceptions, that which our senses take in, our perceptions, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. Those are the five senses. So, that's how we perceive the world, is through our senses. And then there are mental formations, which are called impulses. The word translates as impulses, mental impulses, but it really means thought constructions, thinking, our thinking mind. And then there's the fifth one is consciousness, which is awareness. So we talk about our mind a lot. You know, something's on my mind, and we use this word mind, you know, all the time, and we think there is such a thing. But if you really look at the mind or analyze the mind, you find that the mind is consciousness, various levels of consciousness, all working together with the brain. Brain is like an organ that organizes. It organizes the various levels of consciousness. And it's a kind of receiver and transmitter. And consciousness works through the brain. And the brain is the organizer of consciousness. But the brain is the brain. And the mind is in my understanding, is of the various levels of consciousness. So the various levels of consciousness are all working together, and I talk about this from time to time, and it's my favorite subject, which is how consciousness works and how the ego is formed as a level of consciousness. The self is a level of consciousness. All the various levels of consciousness are there working together, but there's no self in it. But we feel a self because one of the levels of consciousness is making a mistake. And it's calling itself me and mine and so forth. It has a job, but it takes the information that it's supposed to be relaying and centers itself around that information and thinks that it's the boss. So we can't get rid of the ego, but we don't let the ego, we say to get rid of ego means to put it in it, to let it do its job rather than its false job. Its true job is to convey information. It's called manas. Manas is the level of consciousness which conveys messages. But sometimes the messenger thinks it's the boss. And that's the problem we have. We take all this information consciousness takes, this level of consciousness takes the information that it's conveying and thinks that it's the owner of it. And so then we create a self because it's the thinking consciousness. It's wonderful. You know, all of our thoughts, imagination, wants, likes, dislikes, this level of consciousness discriminates. So discrimination means to divide, to compartmentalize. And then, which is important for our life, you know, to discriminate. But the problem is that our consciousness, this level of consciousness, creates a self out of its discriminations. Of like, dislike, want, not want, so forth. And creates a lot of trouble. So, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty. Form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are all empty and was saved from all suffering. Now, the next dialectic talks about that. O Shariputra. So Avalokiteshvara is talking to Shariputra. He says, how do you course in the from the Prajnaparamita, Avalokiteshvara? How do you do that? And Avalokiteshvara says, oh, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Impulses mean mental formations. This is an old translation. So, so emptiness is what is not produced. As we read the 20 meanings of emptiness, emptiness is not produced, is that which is not produced. We call it various things. We call it the Dharmakaya sometimes. Sometimes we call it Buddha nature. Sometimes we call it essence of mind. Sixth ancestor calls it essence of mind. Suzuki Roshi calls it big mind. But it's beyond description. There's no way to describe emptiness. But all the forms are the forms of emptiness. So we call it, say, essence and function. So essence is not graspable, not seeable, hearable, tasteable, but all of the forms, whatever is created moment by moment, are the forms of emptiness. So emptiness and form is one thing. Sometimes in the koans, there's a phrase, the king goose can extract the milk from the water. And water and milk are mixed. The king goose can extract the milk from the water. That's very subtle. Nobody can do that. Once you mix it, Dogen says, all of the real practitioners should practice like peacefully, like, or like milk and water, like milk mixed with water. It should be that harmonious, because there's no separation. So form does not differ from emptiness, even though form is form and emptiness is emptiness. So that's what's missing here. We say emptiness is form, form is emptiness. That which is form is emptiness, that which is emptiness form. The same is true with feelings, they're all empty. Perceptions, all empty. Mental formations, all empty. Consciousness, all empty. But empty also means present. Empty doesn't mean, it's a word, you know, shunya. Shunya means without characteristics. Something like without characteristics. So emptiness is, it's called emptiness because it doesn't have any characteristics that you can identify. Yet, everything that is formed, without exception, is an expression of emptiness. So you can say it's kind of like clay or gold, which is molten, and then you pour it into various molds, and it comes out as tin soldiers. You and me, and all of the things, things changing, continuously transforming realm called the world or the universe. So emptiness is the basis of everything. And you can't separate the basis from its inventions. So each one of us is a form of emptiness, and that's our true nature, is emptiness, because we don't last more than a moment. We think that we get to be a certain age, you start a certain age and then you grow up and you have middle age and you die and you get old and you die, but it's all empty, even though it's full. So emptiness also is fullness. Emptiness is the space in which everything can move. If there was, this is on one level, if there's no such thing as emptiness, I mean, if it wasn't for emptiness, we would all be in the same place forever. But everything is continually moving more than we are aware of. If we were really aware, we would see how everything is changing so fast and so continuously, but we have a certain momentum in this moment. It's very interesting. If we have a certain sense of time, right? But if you were on Mars, you'd have a different sense of time. And traveling through space, you have different sense of time. So someone grows old here would not grow so old in a different traveling through space, and the further out you go, you'd have a different sense of time, and you wouldn't be so old. Come back and or maybe you'd be older, but usually it's the other way around. Because we think that time is something, you know, that we have, but it's all relegated to this particular environment. So we grow according to our environment. We're just pieces of this environment, like trees and plants. We're part of this environment. So, but we think we're some, you know, that the universe revolves around us. our universe revolves around us. You know, this is my universe right here, at this moment, revolving. I'm doing the talking, you know, and you're doing this. But it also revolves around you. It revolves around each one of us, and each one of us is in the center. We're all in the center. We're all in the center, and these universes are going around us. But actually, because we have a self, because we are self-centered, we just see the universe is flowing around us. And it was very hard, you know, in Christian days, in the Christian world, to realize that the earth is not the center of the universe. I don't think they have that problem in the Buddhist world, but I'm not sure. Because in the Buddhist world, there was no God who created anything. This Buddhist world is just form and emptiness. They're just conditions which keep conditioning and keep causes and conditions which keep rolling along and create what we think is our momentum. And so we're self-created beings. We have form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And we think that is myself. And yeah, it is, you know, that is myself, but it's not a real self. It's a momentary manifestation, and we identify with it moment by moment. And we have a past, and we have a present, and we think we have a future. But future is an idea, even though we believe that tomorrow we'll get up and do something. But it's not guaranteed, it's just an idea. And so there's this shifting world without any real foundation. All of our plans, all of our works, all of everything we do is built on shifting sands. And we think it's going to be great. Think things are going a certain way, and then boom, they go another way. And then we all are going, boom, they go another way. That's the way it is. I remember after the Second World War, we thought, geez, now everything's going to be great, you know. The Nazis are defeated, and all this. You know, it all fell apart because it has to. It all has to fall apart. There's no way it's not going to fall apart. And then something else starts, and then it falls apart. And then that's so. If we stick to a self, then we get caught in the tectonic plates of our life. So, when we have a reduced or accurate understanding of self, we realize that it's always shifting, and that we have to continue to shift with everything and not get caught in good and bad, or right and wrong. And so we invent good and bad and right and wrong in order to give ourselves stabilization. But there is no real stabilization. Some people can live their lives, you know, in a very nice way, but it's an anomaly. We always have problems. We always have problems. And the more we stick to something, the harder the problems are to deal with. So, Avalokiteshvara is saying, Shariputra, this is the understanding. That form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Emptiness is not different from form. You can't separate them. That which is form is emptiness. You can't separate them. That which is emptiness, form. And the same is true of what you feel is yourself. These five skandhas are like the building blocks of self. The categories. The dharmas are the particulars. So the skandhas are the particulars, and the dharmas, and the skandhas are the building blocks, and the dharmas are the ingredients, so to speak. So the dharmas have categories. You know, the form dharma has, I mean, the form skandha has all of the elements that constitute the body. And each one of those is a kind of dharma. Each of the particulars of dharmas. And feelings has its own, you know, we have good feelings, bad feelings, and neutral feelings. We have feelings, the bad feelings, I'll read you the list of the dharmas. Just cursorily to give us some idea. So this is the 100 dharmas. I'm not going to read all of them. Just to give you an idea of the Yogacara school, the 100 dharmas that they study. So. There are 8 levels of consciousness. Those are all dharmas. And then there are general dharmas, which are touch, sensation, thought, idea, volition. And then there are special dharmas, which are desire, resolve, remembrance, concentration, and wisdom. And then the good dharmas, klesha, the kushala dharmas, are belief, or faith, shame, bashfulness, language is old, faith, shame, bashfulness, absence of covetous generosity, the negative, absence of hatred, absence of ignorance, energy, repose of mind, vigilance, equanimity, and non-injury. And the wholesome dharmas are, unwholesome dharmas are covetousness, hatred, ignorance, arrogance, doubt, and meaning skepsis, and false view. And the minor evil dharmas are anger, enmity, concealment, affliction, envy, parsimony, deception, fraudulence, injury, pride, shamelessness, non-bashfulness, being too forward, restlessness, low-spiritedness, disbelief, lack of faith, sloth, negligence, forgetfulness, distraction, and non-discernment. And then there are some intermediate dharmas like repentance, drowsiness. They're indeterminate. They're neither good nor bad. Reflection, investigation. Then there's from the body elements, the form elements, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, form, sound, smell, taste, touch. Forms included in dharma, ayatana. Well, and then there are all these, we'll talk about these later a little bit. I don't want to get too much into the dharmas because that's a whole, I get carried away. But, so you get have some feeling of what they're talking about when we talk about dharmas. Right? There's dharma and dharmas. Dharma with a capital D means Buddhist teaching, truth, and stuff like that. Dharmas with a small D mean these. So the dharma is the study of the dharmas. The Dharma is the study of the Dharmas. And so the Dharma, Abhidhamma, was the study of the Dharmas as practice for the Abhidhammists in early Buddhism. And it's very boring because it's all about analysis, but it's also interesting, you know, and it gives us a foundation. It's a wonderful foundation, but one of the problems with it is that in Sanskrit or Pali or whatever, it was used as a mnemonic device. To repetition was used, and so they chant this over and over, and with the same chant, and then one word is changed, and then the same chant, and the next word is changed. So it's for children to learn, or for, you know, in a mnemonic way, device to you chant this over and over and over again. But to read it is really boring because it's so repetitive. Anyway. So, but the dharmas are important because when we talk, you should understand what dharmas are. Dharmas can apply to anything. But strictly speaking, in a dharmic study, it applies to the form dharma, and the rest are mental feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Those four are mental. And the first one is form, which is not mental, even though body, mind are not separate. So as we read or study through the Heart Sutra, it's important to have some understanding of the dharmas, because that's what it's talking about. The mark, because when you read the next line, it says, O Shariputra, here he's teaching him again, all dharmas are marked with emptiness, as well as skandhas. All the dharmas are marked with emptiness. So marked means that their true characteristic. So the characteristic, the mark of fire is heat. The mark of water is wet. Right? So these are the major characteristics. You say, what is the major characteristic of water? You say, well, wet. What is the major characteristic of fire? Heat. But here it says the main characteristic or mark is emptiness. Even though wet is the main characteristic of water, the real main characteristic of water is emptiness. Because all dharmas mark is emptiness. The mark of all dharmas is just emptiness. The true characteristic of everything is emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear, meaning they're not born and they don't die. Appear and disappear. Things, dharmas manifest. Manifest is a good word, I think. Manifestation. Something manifests for a moment. But we use the terms born and die. So that's, we do use those terms because they're convenient for us. When something appears, we say it's born, and when it, you know, fails to appear, you see, it dies. So, but actually, there's only transformation, continuous transformation, because causes and conditions are continually transforming. So this is called the world of transformation. Samsara is called the world of transformation. Basically, that's what it means. It means various things, but I like transformation because samsara is the place where we live, where nothing lasts for more than a second, I mean a moment. everything is momentary. And so the discontinuation of when one thing dies, so to speak, another thing appears. So without death, there's no birth. Without birth, there's no death. So everything has to. But it's not, so the sutra says they do not appear or disappear. It's just endless appearance and disappear, endless appearance, but not, it's not really a true birth, because there's no foundation. And they're not tainted or pure. So the dharmas are not tainted or pure. We just give them that appellation. We divide pure from impure. So this is the kind of criticism of the Hinayana. Because the Hinayana is always, structured on the separation of the pure from the impure. The pure practice. Pure, for Hinayana, pure practice is separating the dross from the pure. Mahayana practice is within the impure is the pure. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. But form is form, and emptiness is emptiness. We have to understand that as well. Emptiness is emptiness, and form is form. Otherwise, you couldn't have form as emptiness, and emptiness as form. So, not so easy to understand. Next time, I hope we can get to Abba Dabora, which may be more interesting. My monologue. he is interesting. He's got some really good stories. So, I didn't ask you for questions, but you're welcome to.
Yeah. You said that emptiness has no characteristics.
Yeah.
If I say, and the characteristic of emptiness is no own being, where's the problem with that?
It has no characteristics and no non-characteristics.
Let's just stay with the characteristics part of it. You say it has no, what is wrong with the characteristics part of it? I'm saying that having no own being is a characteristic, isn't it?
It's a characteristic we give it.
Right.
But it's not its characteristic.
Why not?
Because it has no characteristics.
That's what I just said, though. You're saying exactly what I said.
Tell me its characteristic.
Having no own being.
No own being. Well, all dharmas have no own being.
Right.
Didn't say emptiness has no own being.
But so
all dharmas in their own being are empty.
Right.
Yeah. All dharmas in their own being. That own being is important. And what it means is that everything is dependent.
Right.
Nothing exists by itself. Everything exists dependent on everything else. That's the general term we use when we talk about emptiness. In order to get a hold of it, we say emptiness means interdependent. And so own being means nothing has inherent existence. So everything is dependent on everything else. So it's just one whole being with many different forms. But there, but nothing is everything is independent and at the same time dependent. All the independent entities are dependent. There are no independent, no truly independent entities, but there's, so Suzuki Roshi said independency, the tendency to be independent. Everything has a tendency to be independent. You have a tendency to be independent, but right now you're dependent on me, because and I'm dependent on you.
So you say that emptiness is not dependent on
me? Yeah, one of the uncharacteristic characteristics of emptiness is that it's not dependent. Because every time you try to pin something on it, it's not right. It can't hold up. So you can't pin anything on it. If you could, it wouldn't be emptiness. But it can do whatever it wants.